Hello, it's Wednesday, May the 19th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we're telling you, even if you do go on holiday, it's not clear you'll be going anywhere unless it's on the green list, check the holiday small print. Money Mail have a very interesting report. Universities. Some university tutors are insisting they're going to continue to teach online. Why? When schools have been back for months. Obesity. We're the fattest country in Europe. But first, that chaos at the airports, it's simply going to get worse and worse. I'm asking, why? Travellers arriving in the UK are facing ever-growing queues at airports. Passengers are reporting they're waiting alongside also travellers from red list countries such as India. Border Force warned last week that passengers should prepare for long waits. Heathrow is warned that flights could even be diverted to other airports. And just to add to the chaos, Boris Johnson at Prime Minister's Questions today has confirmed that amber list countries are not for people to go on holiday to at all. They're only for essential travel. To try to make some sense of all of that madness, aviation analyst Alex Macheras joins me now. Alex, first of all, I can't understand why Heathrow Airport, which has been shut effectively for the best part of a year, doesn't open up all five terminals to try to limit some of the chaos at immigration and border control.
You're right. And, you know, you would think if they were choosing not to open all of the available terminals, then at the very least, they would have a dedicated terminal for those red list arrivals in order to separate them in the queues from the green list. But actually, that doesn't happen. If we speak as recently as this week, just earlier in the week, the queues at Heathrow were reaching 4 to 5 hours. At one point, passengers realizing that they were queuing less than half a meter away from other passengers from countries on the so-called red list, because, and you know, Heathrow even come forward and say, well, this is the fault of Border Force. They say we tell Border Force how there are solutions and they choose not to implement those solutions, but also they actually go further and they admit that social distancing isn't possible in the arrivals hall, in the immigration hall, which begs the question, just how safe is this arrangement? And it's certainly not sustainable for the larger numbers of travel expected over this coming summer period.
But why won't Heathrow Airport open up all of their terminals? Is it because they're trying to save money because they've had a terrible year, or they don't? Is there not sufficient staff? I just can't understand it.
They say that it's the operational costs of having all of those terminals running when air travel demand has been ultimately on the floor for so long. So they really do blame the costs of keeping those terminals closed. And just to give you some context, for example, when London Heathrow Airport's Terminal 4 closed down, staff were informed that it would be closed for just a few weeks. Now there are airlines there who used to operate from that terminal who are still operating 2, 3, 4 flights per day. They have the numbers and the capacity, but Heathrow is insisting that they will continue to funnel them through the same open 2 terminals, which is causing and adding to the nightmare scenario of arriving to this country when international travel should ultimately be able to occur safely with a consistent set of measures, but most importantly, as you touched on earlier, with clarity. And it's this lack of clarity that is nothing short of a disaster right now.
I agree. And this has been a hobby horse of mine for a long time, Alex. Is the fact Heathrow Airport is run by a company based in Spain, are they not putting the interests of flight, of travellers, of the airlines first here? They're worrying about profits which are being paid perhaps back in Spain. I mean, are they doing the same in their airports that they operate in Spain? Are they all being operated to sort of cut price?
Well, we haven't seen the terminal shutdowns that we have in the UK, that's for
sure.
But I wouldn't necessarily, though, pin that specifically on those majority investors. Actually, for Heathrow Airport, one of the largest single shareholders are Middle Eastern investors like Qatar,
right,
for example.
Okay.
You've got other countries who actually I know with very reliable sources that they were reaching out to Heathrow with frustration, saying, let us implement these measures. Let us take over the arrival experience to have this flow of passengers, because they want to fly to the UK, because they recognise it can be done and should be done in a safe and consistent way. And for some reason, Heathrow has continued to resist. They blame operational cost. Again, all of this, if we move away from the business and we look at what it actually means, it does mean that for passengers, it is a real headache arriving to the UK right now, whether you live in the UK or not.
Now, what of the other headache? So after days of confusion about what this wretched traffic light system means, green, amber, red, we all thought amber meant you could go on holiday to amberless countries such as Spain, but it would mean you'd have to quarantine for some days when you get back. Now, after days of confusion, the Prime Minister in the Commons today has said, no, you're not to go on holiday to amberless countries. You're only to go to amberless countries if it's essential travel. Now, I presume thousands of people have already booked holidays to go to amberless countries.
I would argue that the Prime Minister here is simply speaking as to what perhaps came to his head in that moment in PMQs. If we're looking at the law legally now, anyone for any reason can travel to any of the countries that that are on either the green, amber, or even the red list. That international travel is now legal. The guidelines state that perhaps you shouldn't travel to the amber or red countries,
but they're just
knowing
guidelines.
What you face if you return back to the UK. And I want to be really clear, the UK does not determine or decide where people travel to. They merely determine and decide what people face when they arrive back to the UK. And even there, we've seen the dithering with the India red list saga and the mess that was caused back then.
Just remind people listening, Alex, if you do say to hell with the advice from the Prime Minister, and if you listen to the Environment Secretary, he gave completely different advice yesterday, of course, but that's 24 hours in this government. If you do go to an amberless country, when you come back, you have to quarantine. Is it for 5 days at home? It's not in a hotel, but you have to quarantine at home. Is that the plan?
Exactly. I think that there would be far more effective measures and if there were consistent messaging with the following, which is that green, no quarantine, but tests when you before and after travel to the UK. Amber, if you're flying from an amber country, it's a 10-day home quarantine with two tests. However, if you do pay for a third optional test on day five and you're negative, you're released. Red list, that is the travel ban. You can still travel back from some red list countries on direct flights like India. Mm. They have maintained the flight routes. However, you will be escorted straight to those hotels near the airport.
But why are they allowing any flights in from India at all?
Well, it's unusual. And the Department for Transport, who I've spoken to over the last 24 hours, say that it's to ensure that Brits are able to return home to the UK. But of course, that doesn't extend to so many other countries on the red list, where the first thing the UK government did was pull the plug on direct flights. So that, again, is inconsistent with the government's own handling of the red list. Again, I had spoken to you just weeks ago when we were both wondering why India was not placed on the red list.
Yeah, that's
at that time, and we know that it was directly linked with the Prime Minister's then, you know, should have been trip to India for a trade deal.
Yeah, he wanted to sign a trade deal. I just don't know, finally, Alex, who's meant to be responsible for this policy? Because if you ring the Home Office, oh no, not us. If you ring the Department of Transport, they say not us. So we're still trying to work out who is responsible for this mess, but ultimately I suppose it's the Prime Minister because he's the Governor.
Exactly. It's that, you know, the head of our UK government, of course, is the Prime Minister. And that's why I think at the very least he owes the public, the travel industry, the people that have been separated from their families for a long time. He owes them a level of clarity and consistency. Yes, you are able to move to these places, but here is what you will face when you get back. And so long as you can get on board with that, then international travel can resume safely, so long as each person is aware and complies with the measures that are in place.
Fascinating, Alex, not least because, of course, the European Union were expecting any day, any hour now, Alex, ambassadors to say that they want Brits to return to EU countries. So to hell with what the Prime Minister said.
They've done it about an hour ago.
There we are. Over there. First with the breaking news here. They've done it. So that really means everybody's going to be going on holiday to the Greek Islands and the Spanish Islands, whatever the Prime Minister may say in the Commons, I guess.
It's, as I said, it's one thing for the UK to attempt to determine where people are going. Ultimately, if we look at it properly and how it is, you know, it's actually the UK determine what you face when you arrive to the UK, whether you are a resident living in London or it's your first time visiting the United Kingdom for a vacation. That is the procedures that you have to go through. It's the other countries, just like before the pandemic, that decide how and what you will need to enter their nations.
Fascinating. Alex, I'm sure we'll be talking about this again and again in the days and weeks ahead. That's Alex Macheras, who's an aviation analyst. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. And remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So 1 million people were admitted to hospital due to obesity last year, as cases where obesity is a factor soared by almost a fifth year on year. This is according to figures through NHS Digital. Some people say the figures are shocking and they're an illustration of the growing obesity crisis. I'm joined now by Tam Fry, who's chairman of the National Obesity Forum. Tam Fry, hello to you. It's no secret now, is it, that obesity now is a bigger threat probably to the nation's health in many ways than lung cancer and other forms of cancer?
It is indeed, in the sense that the obesity by itself is going to cost the country £6 billion to cure. But it's the disastrous effect that excess weight has on all these other conditions. And even as I speak to you, I'm looking at a list of them, and they're probably about 24 in all, which are triggered by excess BMI. And the real tragedy is that there's no move from the government yet with any kind of urgency to clean up the problem. And that's going to bode ill for the future.
Well, they've introduced a sugar tax, haven't they, on fizzy drinks? That's made a difference, hasn't it? That's progress.
We know that it's made a slight difference, but I have to tell you that one measure like the fizzy drinks levy is not going to cure the problem. The government is actually looking, or has been sent, two different strategies, one from the previous chief medical officer, Professor Sally Davies, that was actually listing about 60 different things that need to be done in concert under a centralized direction from Whitehall to make any sufficient knocking of the problem. And the other one was another from the Global Institute, McKinsey Global Institute, which listed 44. So there are a great number of issues which have to be addressed. So just the sugar levy by itself is not going to work.
But aren't they going to introduce a ban on junk food adverts?
They will introduce the junk food adverts. They will introduce the curb on promotions. Those two things will be of benefit, but those are not coming in until next year. Hopefully that in the interim, we will see some movement on an extension of the sugar levy. Because in my view, the fizzy drinks levy, which was a success, actually opens the door to a whole number of other levies which could be quite appropriately levied on industry in terms of biscuits and cakes and all the items which we unfortunately are offered, which are full of sugar, which is very injurious.
What is the key to getting this obesity crisis under control? We are the fattest country in Europe. We know that. Why are we the fattest country in Europe, Tam Fry? And small piecemeal measures like sugar tax and publishing the lists of calories on menus for meals are small steps, but clearly nothing like what's needed, because this problem's getting worse every year.
Well, the issue actually is one of leadership and direction. And many, many commentators have said, you're not going to get anywhere unless you have somebody who is in power, who has control of how this implementation works. And that, of course, it has got to be done within either in Downing Street or the Cabinet Office or at the center of power. And that person would then have the backing of the Prime Minister to oversee what each department is doing in its own way. So, if you will, there are a lot of things that have really got to be done in terms of agriculture. So that would bring in the Ministry for Agriculture. And you extend that all around government and you bring it all together. My favorite at one time, which was 10 years ago, was that John Prescott should be this obesity czar. Mm. Because he was the kind of guy who knew how Whitehall ran, who knew what was possible and what was not possible, and boy, could he knock heads together. And it needs that kind of overall direction.
Well, if you recall, you don't need me to remind you this, of course, Tam Fry, that the Prime Minister said he would review stealth sin taxes, and this was after admitting his own obesity was a major factor in his battle against COVID last year. That battle, of course, which could have very easily killed him.
Yes, and I'm if it doesn't sound nasty, I had great hopes that the Prime Minister would come out of the intensive care at St. Thomas's Hospital and actually get down and say, right, enough is enough, we've got to do something about it. You have to recall that when we had the swine flu epidemic in 2010, Whitehall was told, or the Prime Minister that those days, David Cameron, was told in no uncertain terms that swine flu or a viral infection, which is equivalent to swine flu in a sense, COVID is not equivalent, but it's even worse, actually would spell disaster for obese, because there were hundreds of people who died in 2010 from swine flu, and all the experts said, come another viral infection, you're going to have many, many more into the tens of thousands. And that may well be the case now.
If I could ask you just finally, is part of the problem too, we know that often the poorer the people are, the more likely they are to be obese. Is that because they're buying, choose my words carefully here, processed meals which maybe go in the microwave, maybe go in the oven, which are cheap? And therefore have very little nutrient and vitamin and have too much of the wrong stuff in them?
You've got it in one. And of course, the real bad thing about the whole of this is that it's the poor areas which attract the junk food shops, because the poor areas can only afford a certain amount of their income for food, and the junk food shops will provide what they want. They will provide food which will fill up stomachs, but they won't provide the nutrition, and that is where the junk food comes in. So you have the poorer the area, and it was announced only yesterday that if you are in the least deprived area, you are probably twice as better off than those in terms of obesity than in the most deprived areas.
If I could ask you just finally, do you practice what you preach? Do you have any susceptibility to food that could make you fat?
I did have. Thankfully, no, now, because of the job that I do. And although it's very boring, I'm the epitome of good living.
Very glad to hear it. That's Tam Vrai, practicing what he preaches. He's the chairman of the National Obesity Forum. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe, and then you can get access to all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces, and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPierce. So, university courses online rather than in person, is that going to become the new norm post the pandemic? Because normality is finally returning to universities as students are once again allowed to attend classes in person. But some universities, including Liverpool, Leeds, UCL and Edinburgh, have indicated they're going to continue to teach some, if not most, classes online into the next academic year. Well, I'm joined now by Professor Sir Dayan Hopkin. He's Principal Advisor at Wells Advisory, and he was Vice-Chancellor and Chief Executive at London South Bank University. So, Dayan, this seems like a bit of a swizz by these universities that want to carry on teaching online. What do you think?
Well, let's be honest. We've had some form of online teaching available for very many years. In fact, you can go back to the beginning of the Open University, and much of that was, you might say, online. The reality is that universities have been experimenting with alternative ways of providing courses. Yeah. You know, you think of the virtual learning environments we've had. So when you say it's a Swiss, yes, the real issue is, what are you paying for? Yeah. And I think what we're going to have now is a mixed economy, where people realize there's a virtue and a value in having online available. You know, who wants to turn up at 9 o'clock in the morning to a large hall with 200 other people, half listening to a lecture? I mean, instead of which, you can have it delivered to you. But it can't be instead of the face-to-face as well.
Right. So you'd have a mix and match.
I think we will be seeing far more of that. On the other hand, there will be a great space for online for those people who can't get to a university, who may want to do postgraduate courses, who would like to have the convenience of being able to study at home. And we know, we've all discovered, that despite all the terrible restrictions of COVID, people have discovered there is something to be said about being able to come to work from home as well as going to the office. So that's the same with education. But I think what we're going to see is a new kind of mixed economy where there will be online provision. That will grow. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, universities experimenting with different modes of delivery. But as I say, one of the key questions is, what are you charging the students for? And I think some students are finding the idea that, they're not going to have as much face-to-face, not as much of the socializing as they had, a bit of a challenge when they're being charged the kind of fees they're being charged. So universities have to be very careful about what it is they're offering.
Well, I was going to say, that's going to be the nub, isn't it? I didn't go to university, but people tell me part of going to university is it's the experience of university. It's the socialisation. It's the cultural side of university. It's also the tutorials. It's the debates in those lecture halls. If all that is taken away, why would they want to pay anything like as much as they are currently?
I don't think you can extrapolate from what happened this year where that people, universities have no choice. They have to go online because of the thing. I don't think any university is going to not go back to some form of face-to-face. In fact, much of the value of universities is that social encounter.
Yeah.
Having said that, we've got a huge number of people in this country who yearn for raising their skill level, who'd love to have extra qualifications, but just don't have the luxury of being able to spend 2 or 3 years in a university. And so what I see is now a very much more diverse educational system with something for everyone.
Now, do the universities have to come to an agreement with the students about how they do this, how they divvy up what's online, what's face-to-face? How is that decision going to be reached? And should the students have some say in it?
I have to tell you, listening to that question, Andrew, I'm very glad I'm no longer a vice-chancellor. Because I think that is going to be the big issue. Because students are asking, and they have been asking for a while, what am I actually getting in terms of hours of exposure to a tutor, access to tutor, kind of libraries? What am I getting? In the end, I think universities will be imaginative. I'm quite confident of that. But students will have to recognize there is a changed world. And for some of them, it'll be a better world because not every student, particularly older students or people with families, and there's an awful lot of those around, they can't always turn up at the kind of regular fixed times that the timetable provides. The opportunity of technology is tremendous because you can now actually offer something of the experience of meeting other people, as well as the convenience of being able to study so much at home. But the package will have to be very clearly calibrated and defined and a price attached.
And just finally, I guess if there is much more done online, that could mean the university estate, if you like, can shrink. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, what does it mean? They'll be selling off assets or closing down the halls of residence?
I doubt very much there'll be a huge change in the estates simply because, there is still growing demand for university education, not just here. And after the COVID, people from abroad, they'll still want to come here in large numbers. On the other hand, just like big office blocks in central London, I live in London, I can see all these blocks going up all the place. And you ask yourself the question, who's going to occupy these places when, you're staying at home 2 days a week or 3 days a week? And I think there's a challenge for all of us to ask, what kind of environment do we want? And that applies to universities as much as anybody else.
Very interesting. That's Professor Sir Dayan Hopkin, who's Principal Advisor at Wells Advisory. So Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here with the latest headlines. Chelsea, exquisite revenge against Leicester. Going to ensure they're in the top four, will it?
Not quite sure, but it certainly puts them in the box seats. There's three clubs vying for these last two places in the top four, obviously, with all the riches involved in finishing the top four, which means you qualify for the Champions League next season. So one of the three, Chelsea, Liverpool or Leicester, look like missing out. And last night's game between Chelsea and Leicester was massive in terms of deciding, who was going to go through. There's still games to go. Liverpool play tonight, so they need to win tonight. And then there's another round of fixtures at the weekend, game, which will finish it all off. But you'd expect now that Leicester are the ones who are probably going to miss out, which is a real hammer blow for them. And they lost 2-1 last night, and then they had a great chance right at the end. Iosi Perez, their midfielder, had this magnificent chance when the ball was squared to him to score and equalise, which would have been good for Leicester. And he put it over the bar, so it was heartache for Leicester so soon after the joy of winning the FA Cup.
Well, they've got a bit of silverware for the first time. They don't get into Europe for winning the FA Cup.
They get into the Europa League, but not into the Champions League. So it's not in the same league. Not as sexy.
Fair enough. And of course, Manchester City, why do they care? They lost to Brighton, who are almost relegated, but didn't get relegated.
No.
But is that because Man City didn't put up a top team because they've got the big Champions League match next week?
Well, exactly. It's interesting. So they've got the Champions League game. So they've sort of gone off form towards the end of the season. They did all the hard work and they were just about there. And then, you know, they kept losing when they were hoping to win to finally seal it. So they lost to Chelsea. Then they won it when Man United lost, if you remember. Then they only just scraped past Newcastle 4-3 in a thriller last Friday night. Now they've lost to Brighton. So they've lost two out of their last three. Now you could argue it doesn't matter. You know, they're just saving themselves because they got the Champions League final coming up in a week's time. But the other argument, of course, is you want to be in great form. You want to be peaking. You want to be, you know, on the rise as you go into the Champions League final. So it's interesting that they're losing these games. And you certainly see the reaction Pep Guardiola's face last night when they did lose it. You know, he wasn't sort of just it doesn't matter. You know, it's not important. So, you know, when it comes to next Saturday in the Champions League final, I'm sure they'll be raring to go, but I'm sure they'd rather be on the back of 3-4-0 wins than on the back of a couple of scratchy performances.
Absolutely. And just finally, he's the England captain. He plays for Tottenham. He's on the way out, isn't he, Harry Kane?
Yeah, so great story that broke on Monday night. It was Harry Kane basically has told Tottenham he's had enough. He's been there for 7 years and he wants out now. He's
local boy, isn't he?
He's local
boy. His local team?
Yeah, sorry. He's been there longer. Yeah, of course, because he's 27. He's always been there. He's been sent out on loan, but basically he's a Tottenham boy, local team. But he's had enough. They've not won anything while he's been there. He's reaching his peak as a footballer. He's 27. He'll be 28 in the summer. And he's basically said to them, you know, I would like to go now. He's got a problem. His problem is he's got 3 years left on his contract, so Tottenham do not have to sell him. Daniel Levy, the Spurs chairman, is a notoriously difficult negotiator. He doesn't let players go for cheap. So unless someone comes in with a huge fee of, like, you know, 150 million.
Oh, ridiculous.
He won't even countenance the idea. Well, exactly, but he won't even countenance the idea of letting him go. And even if someone comes in with that sort of money, he may say, I'm sorry, Harry, you've got 3 years left in your contract, you stay here. And then it would be very interesting to see what Kane does.
So he wants to go to a team where he might win a championship trophy. So that means he won't be going to your team, Arsenal.
He's certainly not coming to us. There's no danger of that. A, we couldn't afford him. B, it would be a backward step because he wouldn't win anything. Yes, it's not. That is not going to happen.
Poor old Matt Catwood. He does try to put a positive spin on Arsenal. What position are they in the table at the moment, Matt? Ninth?
Tenth. But we could go up a couple of places if we beat the mighty Crystal Palace tonight. So,
right. Whose manager's standing down after 4,000 years in football?
Exactly. So I don't expect...
What's his name?
Roy Hodgson.
Managed England.
Managed England, yeah. He is standing... Well, he's standing down from Crystal Palace, but he hasn't quite said that... He's 73, but he hasn't quite said that that's him. So he may pop up somewhere else.
My mate Frank Lampard might go there.
He might go to Palace, or he might go to Tottenham, who haven't got a manager either. Might convince Kane to stay.
If I bump into him in another lift, I'll ask him.
Yeah, ask him where he's off.
I don't suppose he'll talk to me otherwise. That's the Deputy Sports Editor, Matt Gatwood. OK, cheap offers for family holidays abroad may not be as cheap as you think. In fact, they could end up costing thousands. That's according to a new Money Mail investigation. It could mean holiday makers stung for extra fees, for pricey coronavirus tests for travelling while abroad and on their return. And, of course, they might have to pay for 2 weeks in a hotel if they test positive. Money Mail reporter Fiona Parker joins me now. So, Fiona, what we know, a lot of travel firms massively cut the price of trips abroad because of the ban on overseas holidays being lifted. But you've got to read the small print.
That's right. That's very right, Andrew. I mean, we've got, for example, Ryanair has launched a 48-hour £5 sale. And that includes flights to obviously green list countries like Portugal, but also amber list countries where you would have to self-isolate for 10 days on return, such as Spain and Greece. Now, even if you go to somewhere like Portugal, where you don't have to self-isolate when you come back, you're still going to have to pay for free tests. two of these are going to be the more expensive PCR tests that can cost about £150 each. Now, remember, even though if you're in England, you can get a test if you don't have symptoms, if you're getting a test for travelling, you're not going to be able to get one for free, so you are going to end up having to pay for them.
Some of the figures were eye-watering, Fiona. So Money Mail found that a family of four could holiday in Portugal for four nights for £187 per person, but when you've done the testing and the red tape, it could add an extra £4,400 to the cost. That really is staggering.
It certainly is. And I think it's important to remember you can get cheaper tests if you maybe contact your airline or potentially the airport you're traveling from. They might be able to offer you a package deal for less than 100. But plenty of places, private testing clinics, will charge 150 or even more per test. And if you're having free, that means that you're going to be paying per person 450 for the holiday.
Right. Now, what of insurance, Fiona? Because you've touched on that in your piece. A lot of travellers have been given the impression insurance will cover them if the pandemic then affects their plans. Now, we've heard the Prime Minister saying today in the Commons he doesn't want people to go on holiday to amber countries. So some people may follow that advice. It's not an order. It's not the law. Would their insurance company cover them for that if they then say, oh, I better not go on holiday now, even though I booked a holiday in an amber country?
So it's all very difficult because unfortunately very few insurers will cover you for that. And actually it all gets very complicated because although people may see green and think green means go and amber means wait ahead a bit, it's actually all about what the Foreign Office are advising as essential travel. And some of those locations and destinations on the amber list will still be acceptable to the Foreign Office. And if that's the case, then very few insurers are going to payout. And in fact, only 4% will cover you for quarantining abroad, for example. So it's very unlikely you're going to get a payout, unfortunately.
It's going to be a fraught summer because even when you do, if you do get abroad, there's going to be long queues at the airports and all these tests. Do you think it's going to mean, I mean, who knows? I mean, what is there anecdotal evidence that people are now cancelling bookings abroad or they're now going to try and find holidays at home? Because good luck with that, because I think most places are booked and they're very expensive.
Quite. I mean, it's all got very messy because of course you've got some people with or without the government advice and what different ministers and the Prime Minister is saying. You've got situations where maybe people can't afford to self-isolate for 10 days because of their work or job. And also when you go to these countries and these destinations, I think you've got to think it's not going to be exactly the same as maybe when you went 5 years ago. You may even have to wear a mask on the beach. So I think really these are all things people need to have in mind when they're booking.
Mask on a beach? How terrible would that be?
It wouldn't be my ideal of a summer holiday.
Nor mine. That's Money Mail reporter Fiona Parker. Do read her stuff today. Very important if you are thinking of going abroad this summer. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.